Thank you very much, sir. Yeah, we never fake it. We never have to fake it here either because, well, because everything you can think of is true. This pretty much says it all. 7 out of 10 people say America is in decline. Why is that? The government is out of control, taxing those who are producing, taking away personal freedoms, no real leadership, letting precious jobs go overseas while people at home are out of work. This decline has made us vulnerable. America is committing civilizational suicide, and it affects all of us in our daily lives. What are the forces at work trying to bring down America currently? Find out who or what this is, and if Islamic terrorism may be a bigger threat than you know. Lessons from Fallen Civilizations is his book, giving solutions Americans can do now to reverse the decline before it's too late. And over the course of our conversation tonight with Larry Kelly, we will discover the 10 factors that led to the demise of all great civilizations, including ours. We do not have to let history repeat itself. We can learn from the past and prepare solutions for the future, but only if we know the real nature of the threat we are facing. This is going to be, I predict, a big one. We'll be right back with Larry Kelly on Coast to Coast AM. Larry Kelly is currently a marketing consultant to technology companies, a freelance writer, and a former adventurer, not to mention an early developer of the modern, yes, the modern skateboard. Mr. Kelly, that's Kelley, has written scores of columns on the dangers of Western complacency. In his tenure as a political commentary writer, he has made a significant impact. His feature articles have appeared in the Piedmont Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, Human Events, and Town Hall magazine. The result of 10 years of research, his book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, contains the answers to the questions he asked in the wake of 9/11. His book has received critical praise as a saga which begins on the plain of Marathon in 490 BC, and whose main character is Western civilization. Welcome, Larry.
Thanks, John, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
This is an amazing piece of work, and I just want to get right into it. You've been writing this book on and off for about 10 years. What led you to write it? It's very, very nice. It's over 300 pages and very well written, and it takes a while to digest it all. I haven't had time, so you're going to have to do it for us.
All right. Well, people, yeah, ask me that often, and it's my response to 9/11, John. I was, I think, like a lot of people, pretty much at a loss as to why it was that these Islamic terrorists wanted to kill us. And so I remember driving to work the following day. I was working in Silicon Valley at the time, and it dawned on me that, oh my gosh, you know, this is war. And then I began to think, well, if this is war, what will be the follow-on attacks? How many are there going to be? And then I
Right.
began to think also, you know, how many people are plotting our demise? And then finally, I said to myself, you know, can we win this? What will we do? What will we need to do to win this?
Yeah, who are we fighting and how do we beat them?
Yes. And so that sort of began my saga. I think it was like a lot of people, I wanted to do something. I wanted to, you know, I was 51 years old at the time, so I was too old to enlist in the military. So this is my way of also getting into the fight, so to speak.
All right. Now, you write that your main character in your book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, your main character is Western civilization. So what do you mean by this?
Well, I, in my research, I do 5 great civilizations: the fall of Greece, Carthage, Rome, the what we call now the Byzantine Empire, but which was actually the Roman Empire of the East, and then the Ottoman Empire, and that takes us from the 490 BC right up to 1918. And in numerous places along the way, for example, if the armies of Islam were to defeat Charles Martel in in 732 on the battle of, at the Battle of Poitiers. Gibbon, writing many years later, wrote that if Charles Martel loses, then in his day, the boys of Eton would have been learning their lessons in Arabic. Again, in 1683 at the Battle of Vienna, if Jan Sobieski, who is the general in charge of the coalition of armies that came to the aid of the Viennese, if he loses there, again, the Ottoman Empire would have more than likely subsumed all of Europe, and our civilization would have ended. No Renaissance, no Enlightenment,
right.
no Industrial Revolution. So I really begin the story of Western civilization at the Battle of Marathon, where, as Herodotus says in my mutable number two, in battle, free men will almost always defeat slaves.
Yeah.
That's where free men, although greatly outnumbered, won and began this saga that which you and I are inheritors of this civilization. One of the things that I found out in my research, which I thought was fascinating, is that the Greeks came up with the notion that the many should rule the few, and no other civilization untouched by the Greeks ever came up with that idea.
Isn't that something? Let me ask you something. This is really intriguing, and it's at the very beginning of your work. It's immutable law number one. No nation has ever survived once its citizenry ceased to believe its culture worth saving. That is really, really strong. And I would first like to ask you, the citizenry being the common mind of the citizenry,
yes,
decides that its culture is not worth saving. How does this happen? You know what I mean? I know you're not a psychologist, but how does a citizenry come to believe that its culture is not worth saving and just generally accepts it? And I take it after that, the real apathy sets in.
Yes. Very often, it is because the central governing authority becomes a kleptocracy, John.
What do you mean, kleptocracy?
It finds a way to take to impoverish, to take the money from the middle class. The poor are always without money, but
gotcha,
the middle class as well.
Becomes,
and they become willing to see it overthrown. One of the features.
I would say we're there. Sorry.
Yeah.
One of
the features of a failing civilization is very often, the impoverishment of the middle class. That the people in power have a way of taking that money. For example, I think that most of our listeners would probably agree that the fall of Rome in the West, the European portion of the Roman Empire, which is the date given for that fall is 476 A.D., but it had been falling and disappearing for almost a century. But in A.D. 161, during the reign of Emperor Marcus Aurelius, there were about 3,000 officials and bureaucrats in the Roman imperial government. By the abdication of the Emperor Diocletian in A.D. 305, there were 35,000. In that same intervening years, taxes rose from what the small farmer could produce in 2 days a month to his entire monthly output. By the mid-4th century, the empire exacted such an onerous level of taxation that many of its citizens defected, abandoned their lands, and joined barbarian invaders.
Wow. Keep going. This is very interesting. I mean, it's just me and Larry and a few million of our closest friends talking about this, and I'm just stunned at the parallels that I'm hearing already. Keep going.
So, I guess the The book then is, I have the five big civilizations that I mentioned before, Greece, Carthage, Rome of the West, Byzantium, which is Roman Empire of the East, and the Ottomans. And I have a 10 immutable principles that our listeners can think of them as undermining factors. And we can talk about each of them, and I can give you examples. They don't repeat in every one of my civilizations.
Yeah.
Many of them do. And this one is the no nation has ever survived once its citizenry ceased to believe its culture worth saving is one that's very, very common.
All right. Now, let's amplify immutable law number two that you touched on a little bit already. Yeah, it makes sense that free men would generally be able to defeat slaves, meaning conscripted troops, for example.
That's exactly right, John. Yes. I call that Herodotus's law. And Herodotus the Greeks... The ancient Greeks invented so many things, but Herodotus is considered the father of modern history. There were chroniclers that recorded events, but Herodotus was the first to not only chronicle the wars against the invading Persians. Our listeners would remember the recent film 300 at Thermopylae. Herodotus is the source for that battle and that invasion. From Marathon 10 years later, the Persians invaded with a million men. And what Herodotus wanted to find out, and he spent a good 10 years roaming around the Mediterranean after the Persians had been defeated, and he wanted to find out how could such a smaller army. There were not all the Greek city-states banded together. There were only about a dozen, and they were outnumbered 10 to 1, and they won. And he wanted to know, how did that happen? So he was the first chronicler to ask the question, why did something happen, and how could it have happened? And that's what he came up with. He came up with the idea that free men will almost always defeat slaves. Why? Because they're defending their home and their families, and they're not conscripted. They're not treated as slaves.
That's very interesting. You know what comes to mind immediately?
What's that?
That would be the Alamo.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, there's 200 and, I want to say 237 people were in there. I don't know for sure. I'm looking. But, about 1,500 Mexican troops, and they lost between 400 and 600 on the Mexican side. And might I just mention, you know, I was looking at some statistics, the gun rage is the gun stories are we're just awash with it, right?
Right.
But I just came across an interesting stat, which was there are 600,000 hunting permits in Wisconsin and 1.1 million various hunting licenses in Texas. Now, there's been some, there's been some speculation that, do we think the Chinese, since they're all over Central America, they're all over the place, and they've mapped all of our grids and everything else, might actually try to physically repossess our property using their multi-hundred million member armed forces, and that's just the infantry. Could they possibly even entertain such a thought? And it's like, well, more ridiculous things have happened in history. Why not? And I'm just thinking, those would be conscripted soldiers, and there would be one point, just the ones who got permits just in the state of Texas, 1.1 million free men who would be ready to repel this kind of an invasion. So anyway, I digress here. I just pick it up where you left off. But I just thought that's very interesting, because in almost every instance, and I was just talking about Wellington and Napoleon and Alexander and these guys, and then it's almost providential that you should be on the program tonight, because this is a beautiful and much more well-researched extrapolation of that basic topic, and you've put it in this amazing book form. So anyway, let's keep rolling here.
Okay, so in each of my the five civilizations that I where I show you what happened at the fall, or what brought that civilization down. Then I also have a modern corollary. So, with respect to Immutable Number Two, in battle, free men almost always defeat slaves. I also have a modern corollary, and I say, in 2003, some months after the fall of Baghdad, Paul Bremer, U.S. interim governor of Iraq, wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. He stated that Saddam Hussein's army collapsed in a matter of weeks because the Sunni-dominated regime commanded an army of mostly Shiite conscripts who, seeing the U.S. forces moving toward them, deserted and went home. The Shiites, along with the Kurds, comprised the vast majority in Iraq, and hated the ruling Sunni Ba'athist regime. Once they believed the U.S. was finally about to liberate their country, they saw no reason to fight and die for their slave masters who lived in gaudy, heavily armed palaces.
Wow. That's extraordinary. That's not exactly the story that we got at first. This kind of came out later.
Right.
You know?
The initial invasion was, you know, a three-week affair. And
well, you know, it appeared that, you know, they're giving up, they're getting out. It's like, no. They're not committed to this fight. It's not because they're afraid to fight. It's because why should they? This is a good thing in their view.
Yes.
Unbelievable. All right. All right, let's go to Immutable Law Number Three. Appeasement of a ruthless outside power always invites aggression. Treaties made with ruthless despots are always fruitless and dangerous. What's the history and what's the modern corollary?
In Greece, after the long 50-year Peloponnesian War, which was so brutal and so long, the Greeks ceased to have the will to fight. And that, there's a kind of a corollary to that with respect to the two world wars and Europe. I see them as very similar. But in 338, this was about 40 years after the end of the Peloponnesian War, prior to the ultimate conquest of the Greek mainland in 338, the Greek allies, Thebes and Athens, negotiated the Peace of Philocrates with Philip II of Macedon. This gave him their acquiescence to capture and enslave two small Greek city-states which stood in the way of his invading armies. The principle wrapped inside the Athenians' Peace of Philocrates has an immutability and a colossal significance that cannot be overstated for the 21st century West. The attempt by a civilization at appeasement of a ruthless enemy committed to its conquest will accomplish the opposite of the appeaser's wishes. It will always invite attack. Further, the attempt at appeasement will signal that the time to strike is now.
Yeah, well, that's Neville Chamberlain convinced that Adolf Hitler was harmless and everything was fine, and everybody's going to be happy. There'll be no war. And then Hitler bit him hard.
Yeah, exactly. And so people, the operative word here, too, by the way, and everybody knows the Neville Chamberlain example, but the operative word that I wanted to throw out to the audience is this, and that is ruthlessness. Although, you know, the modern jihadists employ ruthlessness as their primary tactic, it's much older than Islam. That being the tactic of ruthlessness, it actually emanates from the darkest aspects of human nature and man's loyalty to a small band of warriors, which is
all right. I'll tell you what, Larry, let's take a break right now. And when we come back, let's go farther into this ruthlessness and just give us a recap when we come back, and let's go forward through the night. Our guest tonight is the author of Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, Larry Kelly. LarryKelly.com, and that's K-E-L-L-E-Y. We'll be right back. John Dean. Happy Saturday night. Well, we're talking tonight with Larry Kelly. That's L-A-R-R-Y-K-E-L-L-E-Y. And I keep spelling it because you might go to LarryKelly.com and just spell it K-E-L-L-Y. New K-E-L-L-E-Y. His book is Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. And this is that wonderful long conversation where we really get to experience the research that he put into the to his work here and where it all leads. That's that crackerjack thing I was talking about. We got to get through this to get down to the prize. And unlike the real crackerjacks, this is a really, really good prize. And it's a good prize for your mind. We shall return in just about a minute and a half, maybe a little longer, here on Coast to Coast AM with Larry Kelly. Thanks for being with us. Please stand by. Okay, Larry Kelly, let's carry on now. Bring us back to where we were. You were saying something to the effect that the jihadists are fierce, but fierceness precedes the fierceness that we see.
Yes.
The ruthlessness that we see now.
I'm sorry?
No, no, go ahead.
Yeah. The thing that I wanted to stress in this immutable number three is the word ruthlessness. Because I think it's a lot of people don't even consider it, don't think about it, don't believe that it really exists. But I ran across this in my research that the jihadist employs ruthlessness, and it's a tactic that's much older than Islam, because it emanates from the darkest aspects of human nature, and comes from man's loyalty to the small band of warriors. And it is a massively powerful urge transmitted by DNA from, you know, tribal millennia.
That's pretty amazing in itself.
Yes, the thing to understand is that very small bands of ruthless thugs have always been able to take over very much larger, submissive, peaceful civilizations.
Yeah.
Think of it this way. In the 20th century alone, John, small bands of brown shirts captured Germany in a small yet committed cell of Bolsheviks, Russia.
Yes, you know, that's absolutely true.
We may look at ruthless, look down our noses at it, and blame, you know, ruthlessness on someone's upbringing or culture or economic status. But we never dream of identifying it for what it is, a strategy that works.
That's pretty scary. Now, by the time you get to where you can be subjected to this kind of ruthlessness, has the citizenry that's having the ruthlessness directed at it, have they pretty much already given up, or can they counter it in some way?
They can counter it, but only when they refuse the attempt or the inclination at appeasement. You cannot appease a ruthless outside enemy. He only wants your submission.
That makes perfect sense. Sort of like arguing with a schoolyard bully. That's an analogy I like to make.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go on. If people cannot avoid continuous internal warfare, they will have a new order imposed from without, meaning outside.
Yes.
Let's draw the correlations between past and present.
As the fifth century wore on, leading up to the disappearance of the Roman government in Western Europe, John, Roman armies continued their long-suffering tradition of proclaiming their generals emperor, while vast portions of Europe and North Africa were being overrun by Germanic invaders. Roman armies continued to fight civil wars, headed by challengers to the throne, when they called them usurpers. By contrast, the Greek-speaking Roman Empire of the East, based in Constantinople. This is after the two civilizations had divided. There was a capital in Constantinople, and the capital was Rome. It actually moved from Rome to Milan. But the Eastern Roman Empire lasted almost another millennium, another thousand years, precisely because the West could not stop fighting amongst themselves. How could they possibly, you know, overcome barbarian invasions, right?
Right.
Constantly having civil wars. And a lot of people don't understand the fact that the Roman Empire did last all the way up to 1453. But the West couldn't stop fighting amongst themselves and therefore disappeared in 476 AD, a thousand years earlier.
A thousand years earlier. All right. Well, now the correlation to what's happening today, when you talk about fighting among yourselves, now is the modern parallel to what happened in the deep dark past, all of these various conflicts that we are involved in?
Well, I draw the analogy to soon after President Obama was inaugurated. He began conducting investigations through his attorney general, criminal investigations against members of the previous administration. These investigations were aimed at senior officials within the Bush administration who had been tasked with drawing up the guidelines for interrogation of captured terrorists. The launch of these investigations did not result in actual civil war, yet it was unprecedented for an American president to signal during wartime that he was prepared to criminalize his domestic political enemies and at the same time offer up a propaganda bonanza to the country's real enemies, who make up what I call resurgent militant Islam.
When you say here criminalize his domestic political enemies, do you see that? Do you see that for you to be able to write a book like this? Clearly, you're keeping up with things that are going on day to day. I mean, I know you're aware of all this stuff,
I
and
am.
some of it, we're just sick of the sound of even the subject in the title of the subject. Gun control this and massacre that and fiscal cliff the other and all this stuff. But do you find that political speech is becoming increasingly dangerous?
I do.
Because it's really beginning to look that way. I mean, you can see a little bit of writing on the wall, but when the whole wall is covered with writing, you kind of have to take stock at that moment, which is why I like exploring these things, and everybody on Coast likes exploring them.
It's a pretty we're beginning, in my view, dangerously polarized, John.
Well, and there's polarization even within the factions. And I'll just toss something out there for the heck of it. I was seeing that an MSNBC host was criticized for not using the president's title every time he mentioned his name. He only said his last name. He didn't say president. And I saw that somebody had sent a message to them, posted on their board, their subscriber board, that said, "Hey, have a little bit of," I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, "Have a little bleeping respect, You progressive leftists don't represent Democrats." And I went, "Wow, now if that doesn't underscore what I've been talking about, that it's we got to stop with these labels. It's easy to polarize by just using a label. You're conservative, you're left wing, you're this, you're that, you're a gun nut, I mean,
Right, or
everybody's got a label."
and of course, assigning people to groups around ethnicity or even gender.
Well, what easier way to like polarize people and separate groups of people from each other than by hanging a label on them?
And demonizing them.
I'll tell you, these human beings are some wacky creatures, aren't they? I mean, what can you say about this? They're just wacky. Something else, Larry, that I find fascinating is you keep making these references to the Greeks, and I've said this until people are sick of the sound of it, but any acting class, anybody that wants to become an actor, an imitator of human character is going to study Greek theater. And I say that's because the stories never change.
Right.
And they don't.
And they invented theater, too.
Well,
They invented sport and
they
Greek
invented
theater.
so
Amazing,
much. Well, they invented the early hippie thing, Remember Plato and his anything but it was Plato that said anything other than food, shelter, and clothing was a perversion. Isn't that Plato?
I don't know.
I think it
Not sure
was.
about, not sure about that. You could be right.
One of the first diatribes about all these kids today, they're just not worth a damn, was written by a Greek philosopher. I think it was Socrates. I'm probably wrong, but I think it was
No,
Socrates.
he actually he was put to death
Yeah, drink the hemlock.
for subverting the young, and he was constantly causing them to the Socratic method, constantly asking his students to question everything, including authority, and then
Well, I hope we
was
do.
put to death for that. So.
Well, that I was just thinking. You're reading my mind there. I'm thinking, well, isn't that what we do here? Question everything. I hope we don't have to drink the hemlock. might be preferable to the future. Some of us believe the global elite have mapped out for us.
Yeah, well.
Let's spin off in another direction, then we're going to come back to another immutable law. Is that okay?
Sure.
And that is, do you see a great global hand in all of this? Like a little cadre of the ultra super elite ones in control that really create all of this through manipulation of money or anything like that? I mean, what do you think's causing all this? The great big overview. You know, people had some separation back when the Romans were going over to the land of mists and naming London Londinium and going, let's go ahead and pull out of here. You know, it's too wet or whatever. Let's get back to Italy. But this stuff is happening all over the world. It's not like you can't just walk over to China.
Are you asking me? Is there an Illuminati running the central bank of the world and pulling all the strings?
Well, ultimately, yes, that is the question, and I suppose in the broad strokes, and is money the thing that controls it all? As the acquisition of wealth, you know, motivated the Romans to like fan out all over the known world.
I think that to answer your question, in my research, I didn't really come to that, you know, aha moment when I said this is the group that's running it all.
Right.
To answer your question, I didn't find that.
Okay.
But what is absolutely true in the United States now is that we are going after not really the wealthy people. What we're doing is we're taking money from the people who earn a wage. But remember, you look at an individual like John Kerry, for example. He's worth $1 billion. He doesn't need
that
a
all?
Paycheck. He doesn't need a paycheck.
We're going only
after
a billion.
People who are just trying to move up from, you know, middle class, you know, the small merchant, small farmer, Roman Empire kind of guy, to maybe somebody that owns a little bit more land, that owns a few heads of livestock and so on. We're going after that guy. And that, I think, is rather telling. The people who are really wealthy, John, are pretty much immune from this you know, taxation that is approaching, you know, 50% for a lot of people.
Don't you find it amazing that the government takes care of themselves? I mean, they really do. Their health care is solid. Their raise was accomplished.
Yeah.
And they just go right on. I mean, I thought that going into public service like that was supposed to be a sacrifice, but everybody gets enriched. They're either enriched and then they get into politics. And if that was not the case, then certainly they will have been enriched by the time they leave politics.
Yes, that is absolutely the case. And so... So I would say that is pretty evident, and I think it's a dangerous road that we're headed down because
that leads us. Go ahead, finish your thought.
Simply because you know, in looking in my reading of history, at some point or another, that individual who is paying over 50% of his income to the government will rebel, cease to be loyal to the central governing authority.
You know, I was talking with someone the other day. We just got into it for a few minutes, and this person said, I'm right at about $200,000 a year. He goes, you know how much I paid in tax last year? $86,000. I mean, so that leads us to immutable law number 5. When a free people, through taxation, is deprived of its ability to acquire wealth and property, collapse is presaged.
Yes. And we've been discussing that. I mean, the classic example, of course, is late 4th century, early 5th century Rome, when, you know, The Roman army was, when it was not attempting to protect their bastions along the Rhine from the barbarian invasions, was turned upon the citizenry. And if a farmer, you know, couldn't pay what was assigned to him, the army would just confiscate his cow or his chicken. You know?
And right.
So,
well, I wanted to hit that again because that's coming. There's no way to service almost $17 trillion debt. There's no way to service this debt. It's too big. There's not enough money in the world to satisfy this debt. It's crazy.
That's right. Exactly.
And I'm thinking that seizures are to follow. I mean, I would like to think, Larry, that everything's going to work out and be okay. But I'm telling you, we seem to be on a path that if we don't stop and find another path pretty quick, we're really going to taste some real pain.
Yeah.
Well, you've got here 1 in 7 Americans is unable to adequately feed his family, is forced to collect food stamps.
Right.
I mean, that's just the beginning.
Right. The middle class earning between, you know, 40,000 and 70,000 a year is the real target. Because that's where the money is. If you look at the income distribution or the taxable income, I have a graph in the book. There simply is not enough income in the 500 to 1 million and up category. There just isn't enough. So the real taxable income is in that 40,000 to 70,000 a year group of people. And so the real plan is to extract the money from the middle class, because that's where the money is, in a myriad of ways, John, through fees, hidden taxes, higher Medicare deductibles, penalties and fines, carbon taxes, special assessments to cover failing hospitals and school districts, crony capitalist stealth value-added taxes, and the biggest tax of all, inflation. I wrote a piece.
Isn't that the truth?
This is a little humorous aside. I'm trying to lighten it up a little bit. I was writing a piece on the city of Oakland, which I think is a pretty dysfunctional city. And I was just kind of wandering around talking to people working downtown Oakland. And this one woman who is a bartender at a fairly upscale restaurant right in the heart of downtown Oakland, you know, they had pretty good, you know, lunch trade and so on. And she was telling me that she got so many parking tickets and the parking tickets in Oakland were something like $60. And she had so many of them with you know, add-ons, because it's, you know, once it's laid over a certain amount, and it goes up and up and up. So finally, the city of Oakland impounded her car. And she told me, she said, and I told the city of Oakland, keep the car.
Impounded her car.
Impounded her car for unpaid parking tickets, and then she realized that she didn't have the money. Like the, you know, right, the farmer with the centurions at the door taking away the cow, they took her car, and she said, "Keep it, because I can't pay."
Well, you know, and you know what's really funny is a lot of people are responding to these tickets that they get for various things, anything from a code violation because they put some trash out on the wrong day to, you know, whatever. And they're just going down there and saying, I'd like to just sit out my time, please. It's like, well, we can reduce this from $150 to $100. I don't have $100. Well, you know, you need to do a little bit of better job with that. I'll tell you what, $50, no. Judge, I don't have $50. I just want to sit out my time. Case dismissed. We'll work with you next. They don't want to hear it, you know.
Yeah. So it's just an example of what I'm saying is that the middle class is while the fiscal cliff, they were not able to let all the Bush tax cuts elapse and therefore raise the taxes on the middle class. They weren't able to do that. But what I'm saying is that it will be done in a stealth manner through 1,000 cuts.
Oh, I totally get it. And the other half of that story is that if you don't come up with that $50, eventually there will be a piece of paper there indicating they have seized your property. We'll be right back. Let's get to immutable law number 6 on the other side of our top of the hour break for news and all that. To hold a territory, a state must be populated by those loyal to the central authority. When immigration overwhelms assimilation, the fall is predicted. This is Coast to Coast AM.